Ship's going astern, we're going astern. When we start...
This is Jonathan Paley of the Nervous Eaters, and you're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC Acra.
Podcasts get made locally at WGXC.org, as all WGXC's locally produced programs can be subscribed to and found in all the usual podcasting places. Tune in for a mind-expanding radio from local news to a travelogue of sounds, either live at 90.7 FM or anytime at WGXC.org.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Tyler Burton of Hudson, New York. WGXC supporters care deeply about creative community radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to WGXC.org/donate. and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
Here's a PSA from Columbia County Sanctuary Movement about what to do if you encounter ICE. In our community, knowledge is power, so let's talk about your rights. You don't have to open the door, and you have the right to stay silent, not sign anything, and in New York, you can record an interaction with law enforcement. If an agent comes with a warrant, it must be signed by a judge to be valid. In public, make sure to stay calm, don't run, and never lie or show false documents. If you're detained, you don't have to sign anything without a lawyer. ICE can use your words against you. So stay silent and ask for legal help. To stay informed, visit our social media account at CCSMNY, and if you are interested in learning more about your rights, call Columbia County Sanctuary Movement at 518-303-3848, Monday through Thursday, 9 to 5 p.m. And if you're approached by ICE agents or see them in the community, call CCSM's Rapid Response Line at 518-291-9386.
These are dangerous times.
Welcome back to Ginger Radio Hour. I'm Justin. On WGXC Acra 90.7 FM at WGXC.org as well. Today on Ginger Radio Hour, we're heading down to the water. Which is why I'm playing a little suggestive Hawaiian surf music here. So today, lots of music, but most importantly, in just a little bit, we're going to be speaking with writer Dan Rubenstein. Dan has a new book called Waterborne. It's all about a 1,200-mile journey he took on a paddleboard from Canada to New York City and back, and of course, about 100 miles of that journey. And actually, maybe more like 150 or 200. Well, we'll ask him. Took place on the Hudson River. And the book is incredible. And I'm a little embarrassed. I learned so much about the Hudson Valley. Things clearly I should have known. But now I do. And that's thanks to Dan. So we'll be hearing from Dan live in a little bit. He's going to join me via Zoom from Canada. And until then, let's hear a little bit of music. This is Ginger Radio Hour.
Took a train.
Ah, who cares? You always end up in the city.
I said to Carl, look up for once.
And see just how the sun sets in the sky.
I said to John, do you think the girls
here ever wonder how they got so pretty?
Oh, well, I do.
Look out upon the myriad harbor.
The boys with their homemade microphones
have very interesting sounds.
Other girls fall into ruin, dropping out of school, breaking daddy's heart
just to hang around. I walked into the local record store and asked for an American music anthology. It sounds fun.
They tore off my skirt and stuck it on the walls at PS1.
Yeah.
go. Where you wanna go? Into the mind. I don't mind. Into the night. Travel light.
The longest train I ever saw went down there, Georgia line. Well, the engine went by. At 6 o'clock, and the cab went by at 9. In the pine, where the sun never shines, and we shiver when the north wind blow. Cross tie, and I'm on my way back home. In the pine, in the pine, where the sun never shines and we shiver when the north wind blows. Little girl, little girl, what have I done? All that makes you treat me this old way. But you have caused me to weep. You cause me to moan. You cause me to leave my home. In the pine, in the pine, where the sun never shines and we shiver when the north wind blows.
Bill Callahan in the Pines. Before that, some Canadian artists to get us set up for this conversation. Destroyer with Travel Light. And the other band Destroyer was in, the New Pornographers with Myriad Harbor. Let me go off to Zoom to get Dan connected into the board here. And while I do that, listen to some more Lenny Okehu and his surfboard. Oh my gosh. Lenny Okehu and his Surfboarders. More music from vinyl. Dan Rubenstein coming up.
Thank you.
back. Again, that was Lenny Okehu and his Surf Borders piece of vinyl I found at Spike's Record Rack in Catskill. The whole album is called Hawaiian Holiday, and you'll probably hear even more from that today. But the best news is Dan Rubenstein has now joined me on Zoom, so I'm going to try to dial him in. Hold on 1 second here on the board. Let's see if we can make this work. Dan, can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine, Justin.
Oh, and we can hear you. That's wonderful. Let me give you a very short intro, Dan. So Dan Rubenstein is a writer, he's an editor, and he's also a stand-up paddleboarder. And he wrote this tremendous book called Waterborne, a 1,200-mile paddleboarding pilgrimage. And as I said earlier, and Dan, you weren't probably on the line, you couldn't hear this, but to be honest, I learned so much about the Hudson Valley from your book that I didn't know. And, you know, I've been doing this show almost 5 years now. The whole point of this show for me is to learn all sorts of things, but especially about the Hudson Valley. And to be clear, I didn't think I'd be talking to a Canadian today who would tell me all these things that I didn't know. So I'm sure you're hearing a lot of that from various people who you talk to, and maybe specific to the region that they are from. But congrats. The book is really tremendous.
Thank you so much. I'm honored to be on the radio in your part of the Hudson Valley, and I call it immersion journalism, right? You sink into a place, you do your reading and your research ahead of time, but then it's being in a place and meeting people, which allows me to understand it to some degree, you know, with a limited transect through it.
Of course, and I mean, we'll get back to kind of the connections and the people that you met throughout this journey, but. For people who haven't read the book, can you set it up a little bit and tell us what you did, you know, without giving it all away?
Yeah, so I'm a stand-up paddleboarder, and paddleboards are kind of weird. They're kind of awkward. They're not very efficient. When most people think about long-distance paddling trips, you think about a canoe or a kayak. But that's not my craft. I'm a SUP guy. And getting into paddling about 10 years ago got me into this idea of blue space, which essentially is the aquatic equivalent of green space. It's what happens. It's where we are when we spend time in, on, or around water. And surprise, surprise, it's really good for us in many different ways, physically, mentally, ecologically as well. And it's not just anecdotal. You go to the river and you feel better. There's lots of really cool research, which kind of draws out some of the things that are happening that allow us to derive these benefits. So I wanted to explore blue space deeply. I wanted to do a long distance paddling trip as kind of the narrative core of a book. I live in Ottawa, Canada. And as much as, you know, I'm drawing to far off exotic places and wilderness and epic grandeur, I also love exploring my own backyard. And I realized that I could hop on the Ottawa River in the city where I live, paddle to Montreal, essentially hang a right and go through Lake Champlain, the Hudson to New York City, backtrack up the Hudson by bus and catch the Erie Canal in Albany. And then from there, it's paddling to Buffalo. You hit the Great Lakes and I could do a big loop through Toronto back to Ottawa. So I decided to do this trip and talk to people along the way about the waters where they are, what this means to their lives.
So for people, I've only been on a stand-up paddleboard once, and I remember really enjoying it and being a little surprised at how easy it was to keep your balance, although I was in really like a very calm estuary at the time. But I really enjoyed it. And but one of the things that I thought about, and then when I was reading your book, you brought up is this idea of perspective that you have on a stand-up paddleboard that is totally different from kayaking, which I used to do quite a bit of, or being in a canoe. You know, if you're on a kayak, you're basically in the water or under it. And then a canoe a little bit higher. But if you're on a stand-up paddleboard, you're a good 6 feet plus above the water. So I just was curious if you could talk a little bit about what that means as you... You know, it's almost like that double dolly effect that Spike Lee uses so famously. I could just imagine, as you talked about, going up and down the Hudson and all these other places, what it looked like to people, but then more importantly, maybe what it looked like to you.
I mean, in my case, I'm 5.5 feet above the water, so not 6 foot plus. But yeah, you can see down into whatever water you're traveling along, and you're looking at fish and turtles and plants and rocks on the riverbed. You're looking at the way the light is playing with the water. So you see things differently than you would while seated. The other thing that I think really differentiates paddleboarding from sit-down paddling is that you can just step off and swim pretty much anytime, anywhere. And when you're traveling on water and it's hot, that's the most restorative thing you can do. So it's similar to canoeing and kayaking in some ways, but very different in other ways. You can see around you better as well. So you see yourself integrated into this aquatic environment. And because you're not seated, your body's free to move around. And that allows you to use literally every muscle from your toes to your fingertips. You can stretch, you can flex, you can kind of keep limber. I can't fathom sitting in a canoe and paddling for 10, 12 hours a day, every day for weeks on end, but I could do it on a paddleboard. And you're right, it's not as hard as it looks. You can't go very quickly. You can't carry too much gear. You have to kind of be vulnerable and subsume yourself to the natural rhythms and forces because they're so much more powerful than you. But it's kind of like walking. And that's the analogy that I like. It's like walking on water and the Jesus thing notwithstanding. It's one step at a time. It's one paddle stroke at a time. You know, slow and steady, you'll get there wherever there happens to be.
And for people who have maybe even never seen a paddleboarder or done it themselves, so it's kind of like a skateboard or a surfboard in that you're picking, I guess, your lead foot, right? If you're right or left handed, is that what I guess I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, you can do a parallel stance or a stagger stance. You can do a surf stance as well. So you can use all three and shift around. So yeah, but it's akin to standing on a surfboard or skateboard in some ways for sure.
And what about the actual paddling? Is it similar to paddling a canoe or a kayak?
Yeah, and I'm fortunate to have had some great instructors and coaches over the years. And you're getting that blade in the water and you're pulling yourself past the board. And even just thinking about it that way allows you to mobilize and use the bigger muscles, the core muscles. So it's not really arms or shoulders. They're holding the paddle, but it's the bigger, stronger muscles that are pulling you past the blade once you get it in water. And if you get that stroke down, it can be a somewhat efficient way to travel. But because it's so kind of metronomic, you have these different stages to it. You have your reach, you have your plant, you have your pull, you feather the paddle back. Sometimes I'll start off thinking about the steps of the stroke, and you know, it's almost like a mantra. And then within a few minutes, you realize you're not thinking about anything, and it has this really meditative quality, like other forms of paddling as well.
It sounds wonderful. So in general, you were on the water during this trip anywhere between, you know, 6 to 10 hours a day, right?
Longer typically. Mm.
Wow.
10, 12, 14, the right of in a 16-hour day. There were a couple short ones, but I had a lot of people to meet. I had a lot of interviews to do. I mean, a part of me kind of wishes that I had just kind of go where the wind takes me and further or shorter, depending on the conditions. But as I like to say, normal people have schedules to keep. So if I told somebody I'll be there in 2 or 3 days, I kind of wanted to get there in 2 or 3 days.
Sure. And Dan, I'm glad you brought that up because I have to say, as a journalist as well, I was a little anxious at times because you were very clearly trying to meet somebody who had been kind enough, you know, to station themselves at a park or at, you know, a place that you wanted to tour or even a lock. And so I you don't make it seem like an anxious journey in the book, but I was feeling quite anxious for you. And I was so glad. It seems like you, I mean, obviously maybe you left out the ones you didn't make, but you made all your appointments.
I'm glad you appreciate the logistics behind the seamless journey that's on the page. You know what? People were so generous and kind and understanding. And I would essentially, as I was getting close to somebody somewhere, we would have a rough sense of where and when we would meet, but I would kind of taper into, okay, I'm 3 days away. And as I got closer, I was able to, you know, the magic of having a phone, coordinate and say, okay, it's not going to be tonight. How's tomorrow morning? And so forth. But people were really accommodating. And I think that speaks to the power of Blue Space, where water people or anybody who wants to or is willing to share their story about water, they want it to be heard, right? And they wanted to support me, and not only to tell me what they were up to in their part of the Hudson Valley or elsewhere on my trip, but people drove me to supermarkets and they took care of me in these really just profoundly generous ways. And that speaks to the power of water again.
Can you tell us a little bit about some of the people you met along the Hudson Valley. I know you stopped in at Catskill and Kingston, but also many other places north and south. A couple of your favorite stories?
Yeah, so I spent a night in Schuylerville. I think it's pronounced Schuylerville, not Schuylerville, which is on the Champlain Canal, on the Hudson River, a little bit north of Troy. And there's a park there, Hudson Crossing Park. And it's on an island. The Hudson River runs on one side of it, the Champlain Canal Channel on the other side. And it was essentially an abandoned, neglected garbage dump for decades. You know, it's where kids went to party. It's where people went to dump toxic chemicals. And about 20 years ago, a group of locals said, what happens if we, you know, what would happen if we started to clean this place up and maybe make it a park? And they were scoffed at and derided and told they were dreamers. But it was one by one, locals got involved, rolled up their sleeves, started taking trash out of the park. Off the island, and they transformed it into this beautiful park. It's a nonprofit that runs it. And not only is it an amazing natural space with access to the river, to parks, to playgrounds, to trails, to pollinator gardens and playgrounds and pavilions for picnicking, it's also a real kind of community gathering place. And people from all walks of life go there. As Kate Morse, the woman who runs the nonprofit that runs the park, told me, you know, we're disassociated from our neighbors. We don't necessarily know who's living two streets over, let alone two towns over. But when everybody meets at the park, you see kind of the diversity and the breadth of your community. And it's not coincidental that Schuylerville, which was a struggling town in many ways for a long time, has been experiencing a bit of a resurgence. And the park is a big part of it. It's created this real strong volunteer community spirit. So that was an inspiring stop to see in situ kind of a place that was struggling, that has rebounded, and to talk to some of the people who have been involved in this resurgence or rebirth.
How about, you brought up Blue Space again, and one of the things I found fascinating was one of the people you spoke to, one of the scientists, talked a little bit about the survey that they had done where they asked people, I think it might have been in the UK, to rate the places where they were quote-unquote happiest. And, you know, happy is a funky term these days, I think. But anyway, it's as good a measure as any when you're surveying people. And they basically said third most was a park, like especially a manicured park or, you know, like a nice park. Number two was mountains, which I understand. We talk a lot about the mountains here in the Catskills. And number one, they said, was water, which surprised me a little bit. But maybe it didn't surprise you.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this sort of comes from environmental psychology. And there's this idea that when you're around water, you know, looking towards the horizon, you get a real strong feeling of extent, of boundless possibilities. You know, change can happen. Good things can happen. But at the same time, and water is an elemental part of who we are, it's the majority of our bodies, it's the majority of our planet. For the longest time as a species, it's how we got anywhere. Plants need it, animals need it, it's essential for life. So you have this sense of kind of boundless possibilities, but at the same time, a feeling of comfort and belonging. And that duality is really restorative. There's other things at play as well, but it just, it makes us feel good. And a mountain lake might be the ultimate happy place, as Matt White, one of the researchers who's done a lot of blue space research, told me. The really interesting I take away from a lot of the blue space research, and again, this is what Matt White told me, he's a British researcher now in Vienna, is that if you're wealthy, if you're affluent, you're probably going to be healthy and happy no matter where you are. But if you're struggling socioeconomically and you have access to a blue space environment that's a quality, healthy place, numbers go through the roof. So when we think about the social determinants of health, obviously, you know, shelter, education, healthcare, economic opportunity are pillars of wellness. But access to blue space can really serve as a powerful counterbalance to help bring about a greater degree of health equity.
And blue space can be a river, a creek, a lake, a giant river, the coast, the ocean, right? It's all of these different things, right?
Yeah, even a pond, a fountain in a city, you know, as long as we're around water. Part of it is the look of it. Part of it is the sound of it, right? You know, you think of running water and the restorative feeling you get from that as well. There's even research, there's some cool research out of Europe about ocean waves and some of the organic compounds that are released from breaking water, ocean waves or river waves, which seem to have a positive effect on our immune systems because we're absorbing or ingesting these compounds, which we have a symbiotic relationship to from way back when we lived around water more. So, you know, the research is ongoing, but it's you know, we know being in nature is good for us for the most part. We know green space is good for us. Blue space might be even better.
I like that idea of the waves. I mean, it's very similar to the kind of tree bathing idea that we get in parks and forests.
Yeah, absolutely.
One of my favorite parts was when you went a little deep on Pete Seeger and the River Keepers and some of the people you met over there. Can you talk a little bit about some of that? Because obviously Pete Seeger, besides his music, he was like a I didn't even know the right word. He was a bedrock, I guess I would say, of New York City all the way up the river, New England. Anyway, it was so wonderful to have you talk so much about Pete and some of his legacy.
Yeah, and when I started to get down towards your part of the Hudson, more and more people referred to him, and they just said Pete, like he was their friend, their neighbor, you know, the guy next door. And there was no last name or no, the activist, the folk singer, you know, the environmentalist. It was just Pete wanted it this way, or that's there because of Pete, which was really nice to kind of be introduced to him in that way. I spent a couple of days staying in Newburgh, New York, with a woman, Patricia Finnerty, who's a volunteer with the Beacon Sloop Club. And Pete started the Sloop Club back in the 60s, when the Hudson was still in really rough shape and Riverkeeper was just getting started. And there was this recognition or awareness that nobody's going to save this river unless we do it. And it was largely blue collar people who wanted to fish, who wanted to be out on the Hudson with their families, but it was just so choked with toxic pollution. And Pete realized that if people don't realize how beautiful the river is, they're not going to want to protect it. So they built these replica boats of river boats from days past and started getting people out onto the water for free sailings. And the Beacon Sloop Club is still running decades later. I got out for an evening on the Woody Guthrie out of Beacon and went for a sail. And it was an inspiring experience. And just talking to Patricia and other Sloop Club members, first of all, she put me up in her spare room, this complete stranger, smelly stranger paddling through. There was torrential rain on the Hudson, and I happened to be off the water for a couple of days and was looking for somewhere to camp. And she said, oh, yeah, you can camp on my lawn. And then, oh, you can stay inside the house. It's pretty wet out there. So just that kind of generosity, but also sharing the stories of that resurgence. And I know we talked about Hudson Crossing Park and that kind of rebirth. But if a river as degraded and as dead as the Hudson can be turned around, and now it's a really healthy, biodiverse estuary, if the Hudson can go through this transformation, then I think anything is possible.
Hmm. So my last question about the Hudson Valley is I think it was your night when you pulled into Catskill, which was one of a couple times in the books in the book where things start to get a little hairy out there because of weather. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about that night.
Yeah, it was July 4th. I left Troy early, like just around dawn. I stayed at a hotel across the street from the river in downtown Troy and kind of found my board in the parking lot where I left it and walked across the street and set off early. Day started kind of rainy and cool, and then the clouds burned off and it got crazy hot. I couldn't swim initially because I had been warned when you go through Albany, there's going to be sewage outflow. If it's raining, don't go in the river. But as the day went on, I was able to swim. And lots of private land on that stretch of the Hudson. So there weren't too many kind of overnight options for places where I could camp. And I camped for the most part on the trip. I had talked to a couple marinas ahead of time and they'd said, yeah, you can stay here. And I passed them and I realized, you know, I had some tidal current giving me a bit of a boost. And, I could swim by that point, by early afternoon. And I just kind of wanted to keep going and see how far I could get. So that ended up being the longest day I've ever paddled. I think it was 41 miles in the end, and it was getting dark. I was just past the Rip Van Winkle Bridge. I think that's the name of the bridge, and it was aiming for the Hoponose Marina in Catskill, another place where the owner had said, yeah, sure, you can stay here if you want. And, people were partying on the shore. It's July 4th. I see some fireworks here and there, and then I realized those aren't fireworks behind me. That's lightning, and even though the forecast hadn't called for storms, the humidity in the Hudson can bring them up pretty suddenly in the summertime. And so I'm dead tired. It's getting dark. And I turned on the Catskill Creek from the Hudson, I think about a mile or so to get to the marina. And I had to paddle crazy hard because the lightning was bearing down on me. The wind was picking up. I got to the dock, tied my board up, left it in the water with all my gear on it to weigh it down in case it got really windy, and ran into the first building that was there. And as it turns out, it was the bar. And the bartender, she said, oh, we're closing. And I saw a couple locals with half full drinks. And I asked if I could just get a beer and wait out the storm. And they obliged and ended up chatting with the three or four guys who were there, and hugs and high fives and just so welcoming and supportive. And ended up being a kind of dicey finish, but a really fun day.
Well, so maybe you can talk, it might be a good way to talk a bit about people, because one of the things that emerged from your book is, I mean, I emerged from it very hopeful. You know, you, whether you were on the Hudson or any other river, or the Erie Canal, and all of your adventure, you were essentially on a highway, of sorts, and, or an arterial route, and you're, getting off here and there like you would at a rest stop, except these are not places necessarily always built for rest stops. And I was just blown away by the number of people that you met who were either interested in talking to you about the paddleboard, they saw what you were doing, or they were just people who like to spend time around water and are curious to talk to other people about it. Anyway, it really struck me as a really hopeful part of your book about the ways that we can talk to people in this world, like really talk to them.
Yeah, and I went into this trip, into this project as a journalist wanting to explore the health benefits of blue space. So I wanted to look at physical health and mental health and ecological health, because spending time in a natural environment encouraged you to want to take better care of it. So that was my mindset. I wanted to kind of talk to people about that. But the further I got and the more I had just incredible encounter and experience with serendipitously met strangers again and again and again and again. And these are people, some of them were kind of similar to me, you know, the odd paddler. Some of them were very different, you know, different age, gender, ethnicity, skin color. You know, they were richer than me. They were poorer than me. They were in a different part of the world. The more I had these all positive experiences, the more I began to see water and blue space as a conduit to connection between people. And, you know, I worry about things like climate change. You know, I think, hey, maybe if we pay more attention to blue space, we can help, kind of reckon with it and deal with it. But we can't even have a conversation about climate change because it's hard to have serious discourse with people you disagree with, right? There's a lot of barriers there. But if blue space can be a spark that allows people to talk to each other in a really kind of basic human way, maybe that's the beginning of something. And I began to see water as having this potential. And I spent some time in Piermont, a bit further down, with a guy named Ben McGrath, who's a New Yorker writer. Ben wrote a fantastic book called Riverman about a canoeist named Dick Conant who canoed around the U.S. for years and years and years. And he's kind of he passed away. He went missing and vanished. But, you know, older, bearded, big, kind of disheveled looking guy, looks like he might be unhoused. And he's the kind of person who you see him on the street in a city or a town, you might cross the street to avoid him. But on the river, everybody was drawn to him. Everybody wanted to talk to him. They wanted to share their stories and hear their stories. And when I was talking to Ben about that, we started to wonder, like, why did his travels on water have a profoundly different impact than they would have had he been a hiker or a hitchhiker? And I think my kind of theory, and no research has borne this out yet, is that water is good for us mentally. It gives us these restorative feelings, so it makes us feel good. It also slows us down. So although some boats go quickly, if you're paddling, you're going slowly. If you're swimming, you're going slowly. If you're picnicking, you're going slowly. So it kind of moderates the pace. And then there's still this element of danger. Drowning is one of the leading causes of unintentional injury death around the world. Flooding, intense storms, waterborne diseases. Water can be dangerous. So people look out for one another around water. And a lot of my interactions with people, they were just stopping to say, hey, are you okay? Do you need anything? Warning me about hazards ahead and so forth. So I think it's just, it's this kind of magical combination of wellness, of slower pace, and of there's a stranger, but I want to make sure if he or she's okay. That's the beginning of a conversation. And it's two human beings just talking. Water happens to be kind of the fluid that connects us, right? So, you know, it, there's a lot of big problems in the world. You know, just sticking a lake or a river somewhere is not going to solve them. But perhaps it's the, it could be the beginning of something and helping to kind of push the pendulum back towards these kind of basic human things that we seem to be drifting away from.
I like that. What, one of the things that that reminds me of is a conversation you had, I think it was in Kingston, where the person who ran the museum talked about the importance of, as they were trying to teach younger people to, I believe, sail or just be on boats, maybe build boats as well, was this idea of slowing down and paying attention. And I really like that. Like it's very clear as you write about your own paddleboarding how much you have to, you just have to be in that moment. Obviously, you have to pay attention. There's, you know, barges nearby, like very lots of danger. But the slowing down thing really appealed to me.
Yeah, Lisa Cook, who's the executive director of the Hudson River Maritime Museum. You know, they were kind of born out of talking about the region's shipbuilding and sailing history, but they've kind of morphed and they've taken on more of a social justice kind of stance these days, I think. And part of that is in these programs that get kids onto the water. As Lisa said to me, you know, you sit down a bunch of children in a classroom, they're going to be fidgety if they have phones or looking at them. But you get them in a little sailboat and they're wrapped with attention. They're focused and they're present. And that's a really powerful opening to teaching them about the environment, about effort, about resilience, about determination, about all these positive qualities. Just jumping waterways for a minute, when I was on the Erie Canal, I was paddling west from Albany, from Waterford to Buffalo, which is kind of against the prevailing winds and against the current in sections where there's current. And so many people on shore would kind of in a joking, funny way say, "Hey, you're going the wrong way." And they meant you're going the hard way. Like you're going against the wind, against the current. And, you know, we would laugh and I would say, yeah, or whatever. But the more I thought about that, the more I kind of came to see that what's wrong with effort? What's wrong with labor? I mean, what's wrong with going the hard way if it gets you somewhere you want to be, right? And I think, you know, not to be a curmudgeonly old man saying kids these days don't understand the virtue of hard work, but anything good, any significant change, any progress is a result of labor, right? We live in an instant gratification society, but if you put in the time, if you put in the paddle strokes, if you put in the miles, you can get somewhere else. And I think being present and you know, putting in the work is also an important kind of value that we have drifted away from as well.
So after you did the 1,200 miles over how many months?
I was on the water paddling for about 10 or 11 weeks over 4 months. It was an inflatable paddleboard. I took a couple breaks after Montreal and after Toronto. I had kind of real life to deal with. But yeah, about 11 weeks of paddling over from June through September.
And did you find that you were fitter than you had ever been after this type of trip?
I lost a lot of weight initially. I had to go buy a belt in Troy because my shorts weren't staying up anymore. I ate nonstop because I was spending a lot of calories. I had my camping food, but if I was in a town with a restaurant or a supermarket, I would just eat giant meals.
Yeah, I wanted to say, by the way, you ate like a 13-year-old, basically.
Yeah. And again, I'm 5'5". I'm not a big guy, but I would eat everything in front of me and still be hungry. I was in decent shape. I think, yeah, you put in this time. I mean, I was tired, but my body was strong. The only thing that kind of hurt were my index fingers from gripping the paddle so long. Those took a couple months to kind of heal. But as I write in the book, I mean, I have the luxury and privilege of having had the time to get into shape to do this trip. I had amazing gear provided by some really generous companies in the U.S. and Canada. So I had all the opportunities to do this well, right? So, you know, I think a lot of adventurers and adventure writing, there's a macho element to it. I'm the fastest, I'm the best, I'm the furthest. I think anybody can do something like this. And maybe not something as ridiculous as 1,200 miles on a paddleboard, But if you have the time and you put in the effort and you have this opportunity, it's not something that only one person can do. It's something that anybody can do, or whatever their version of this type of expedition is.
As long as you have enough peanut butter wraps, right?
I ate a lot of peanut butter wraps. Yeah.
So I have to ask you about that. So, you know, this made me want to do an epic paddleboard trip because I love peanut butter sandwiches. But only later in the book did I realize that you were eating peanut butter wraps, as you call them, which sound like tortillas with peanut butter on them. Is that right?
That's it. Yeah. It was so hot that, and I had no refrigeration, that even, you know, like hard salami or hard cheese and things that can generally be unrefrigerated, I was worried about having them in my dry bags and making myself sick. So it was energy bars and gels and shakes and peanut butter and tortillas.
That's interesting. I've never tried that. And now I'm kind of curious. I'm generally down on wraps, but I like the idea of this.
For dessert one day, further down the Hudson, I had a chocolate bar inside a tortilla just because I needed the calories. And I also had leftover pad thai inside a tortilla, which was kind of leaky and messy, but that was befitting the journey.
I mean, so I think the only thing I wanted more from the book was like a full-on like calorie counter, because it just occurred to me like, wow, you just had to put them on. You just had to feed your face all day.
Yeah, I remember in a town in the Erie Canal, going to a great little Mexican restaurant. You know, Main Street Heritage Building, recently arrived Mexican family started this restaurant, and like not only eating the giant meal that I ordered, but the tortillas and salsa they bring out for the family, eating all of that as one, and then going to the gas station across the street and getting a couple of ice cream sandwiches afterwards, and then still being hungry when I went to sleep that night.
So, I want to transition to your previous book, which I haven't read, but I want to talk just briefly about. But before we do that, is there anything I didn't bring up about Waterborne that you'd like to touch on?
No, I think you hit a lot of the highlights. I mean, it's a non-macho kind of journey, right? And I tried to pay a lot of attention to the indigenous communities and peoples on the territories that I traveled through, and met up with a few folks in Canada and the U.S. who spoke about their experiences, what colonialism has wrought. And there were stories of rebirth there as well. So, conscious of being a white writer, trying to really listen to and channel other people's voices. And as much as the book is my journey, I think it's everybody's story. And, I'm just blessed that so many people were willing to spend time with me, both the people I had arranged in advance to hook up with, as well as, again, the dozens and dozens of strangers who I was lucky enough to meet.
Well, it's a tremendous book. Again, it's called Waterborne, a 1,200-mile paddleboarding pilgrimage. And, of course, it's by Dan Rubenstein, who we're speaking to. But before I let you go, you wrote another book about walking. And I'm a walking and hiking enthusiast. And I'm curious if you could just tell us a little bit about what that book's about, because I've now ordered it from the library.
Awesome. It's called Born to Walk. So Born to Walk, Waterborne, with an E at the end. So there's a bit of a sequel here. I don't know what the third one in the trilogy will be. Airborne is a leading candidate so far, but I don't know what the narrative will be. Waterborne is a continuous journey. Born to Walk is what I would describe as a bits and pieces book. So I traveled around the U.S., Canada, and the U.K. to spend time with people whose lives or work embody different kind of themes around walking, including physical and mental health, but also spirituality, economy, environment, family, creativity, and things like that. And, just amongst the many amazing people who I spent time with, there's a guy in New York City, Matt Green, who was walking every block of every street in New York, and he did it over like 15 years. And I spent a day with him. He happened to be doing Harlem, a stretch of Harlem that day. And I think ideas that I follow up on in Waterborne were born and Born to Walk. That's saying born a lot, because Matt was all about serendipity. And his thinking was that, if you plan a route, if you follow the algorithms, if you go where the internet tells you to go, you're following, an algorithmized channel. If you just draw a grid and walk it, you never know what you're going to see and who you're going to meet. And although Harlem is probably a little bit more animated than other parts of that city and other parts of the state, it was an incredible day. And we just ran into so many really interesting, cool people. So that was one thing that stood out. I spent a couple days in Philadelphia walking with foot patrol officers in a really, really rough neighborhood. It's about 1 square mile. And I think it was averaging about 35 murders a year. And one of the police department's attempted solutions to the high crime and murder rate was to have every rookie police officer do a full year of foot patrol. And the thinking was twofold. One, you have police officers on the streets, seeing people in their neighborhoods and realizing that most people in this neighborhood are good people who just want to live their lives. So it's kind of breaking down barriers from the police's perspective. And then the other way around, you have people who live in these neighborhoods realizing the police don't just show up when there's bad things happening. The police are now part of the neighborhood. So you kind of break down barriers in both ways. And I haven't followed up much since Born to Walk came out 10 years ago, but the early indicators were that it was having a positive effect on crime and community cohesion in that part of Philadelphia. And, you know, you see it, right? Like you, when a police car squeals up to a stop in the middle of a violent situation, it's confrontational. There's a car, there's barriers. If you're just walking along, you're engaging in a really human way, human scale, human pace, and you see one another as people. So that was, you know, even though it was probably 12 years ago at that point, both those experiences in New York City and Philly stayed with me and have kind of informed my thinking as a journalist going forward.
Wow. Well, Dan, thank you so much. I'll be reading that book next, but it's been a real joy to have you here on Ginger Radio Hour. And if you paddleboard down the Hudson River again, please give us a shout.
I'd love to come back down the Hudson. It was one of the favorite parts of my trip, and it's great to be there on the radio this evening. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. Have a great day.
Take care, Justin. Goodbye. Bye-bye.
Sailing up my dirty stream, still I love it and I'll keep the dream that someday, though maybe not this year, my Hudson River will once again run clear. She starts high in the mountains of the north, crystal clear and icy trickles forth, with just a few floating wrappers of chewing gum dropped by some hikers to warn of things to come. At Glens Falls, 5,000 honest hands work at the consolidated paper plant. 5 million gallons of waste a day. Why should we do it any other way? Down the valley, 1 million.